You're listening to the Drummers Education Connection Podcast. Interviews with the greatest drummers in the business and roundtable discussions with industry leaders and teachers from around the globe to help provide performance, insight, and inspiration.
Guess what that is?
It's numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 out of this amazing drum book right here.
That is correct.
It was?
You are correct, sir. That was one.
I knew number one.
Joe's book, yes.
Very good, guys.
Welcome to Drummers Education Connection, everybody. I'm Bart Robley. Thanks so much for tuning in. We got a really special guest with us today, Joe Franco. And I'm a big fan of Joe's. I got to meet you once. I know you don't remember, but I met you in at the NAMM show. And anyway, we're here on Drummers Education Connection for our 176th episode. This is fantastic. And as usual, we're going to kick it off like we normally do. We have a little bit of business to take care of. If you want to help support DEC, you can do so on Patreon. Helps pay for the website and helps us just keep the lights on here and that sort of stuff. So you can do that. Also, if you want to watch us on YouTube, you can do that there. We are now on Spotify. We're on Apple Music. We are on Amazon Music. We are everywhere. I've got, I think, about 15 of the shows up so far. So we're doing all the current one, and then I go grab other ones, strip the audio out, and put it in there. But that's what we have going on. I would like to start, as usual, with good things. So since Rick played the first 5 grooves from Joe's book, I'm going to throw it to Rick. Rick, tell me a little bit about the good things you got going on, buddy.
My good thing is very simple, and it's very silly. I have Rick Stojack Drum Studio stickers. Finally.
Awesome.
And so my students are digging them. When I sell a book, I'm including a sticker in with the book. And when students come in, it's so fun to give them a little sticker. And then I think some people are putting them up in spots, so it's making them practice a little bit more. They see my sticker like, oh, maybe I should practice. So that's my silly good thing.
They put them up all over the place. Every place looks like CBGBs. They're just Rick Stojack Studio stickers.
Exactly.
Where Rick played when he was younger.
Yes, I played my first gig at CBGB when I was 16.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Chip, what's happening in Tucson that's good, buddy? What's going on today?
It's not happening in Tucson. Right now in Switzerland, they finished up a brand new batch of Agner Chipritter Signature Model Tree sticks from the Magic Trees and Magic Forests in Switzerland, and they're shipping them out to me, and I can't wait to get them.
That's awesome. Fantastic.
Those sticks spin themselves. They're that.
Yeah,
good.
They do. They're magic sticks.
Like clockwork.
Exactly.
Oh.
Jeremy, what's happening with you?
Oh, things are really good, guys. I've got a really, really great show coming up on Friday with my son, which is always a super treat for me to play with him. For those, Joe, this is your first time on the show. My son's a terrific jazz piano player. He's about to go off to college, and we're playing a show together on Friday before he leaves, and it looks like it's going to be sold out, so super excited about that. And then a week later, we take him off to Northwestern, so really, really excited about that.
Fantastic. Well, I got some, we just got off the road. Sam Morrison Band just did 4 great shows back in the Midwest. I got a show this Friday night, and then I have a month off. So I'm just going to be working here in the studio. No touring, but I've got a record I'm working on. Got some lots of students, and just got 3 new songs signed to Noma Music out of Texas for sync licensing. So I'm really excited about that. So that's going good. Joe, what about you? What good things do you have going on in your life? What's happening with you, my friend?
I've got a golf tournament on Friday.
I love it.
I play the drums every day, mostly in this room that you see right here. Work on stuff that I like playing, you know. I do not tour. I do events, done a few really fun events this year. I'm kind of like, you know, have a nice, easy life and stress-free, play for me.
Love it.
Good for you.
Hey, wait, before we go any further, Joe, what's your handicap?
Well, let's not talk about that. It's
you and Jeremy.
On a good day, I'm a bogey golfer. Have all the shots, but it's not like drums, you know? If right. it were as easy as drums, I'd be amazing because yeah. I play a lot. But it's kind of like, you know, it's hit and miss. If I miss it, if I flub a shot, I'll drop a ball and it'll be perfect. And it's like, why didn't you do that the first time?
We call that really with my friends, we call that second team All-American.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. We're kicking the show off this way. Our friend Matt Starr, when he saw you were going to be on the show,
he texted me today.
He goes, hey, ask Joe about my golf game. So let's right out of the gate, tell us about Matt Starr's golf game. how good is Matt?
All right, I played with him once, and it was last summer. So last summer, a good buddy of mine from Connecticut, Joe Calzone, you might know the name from Calzone Cases. He also owns Anvil Cases. Oh. He has three huge places in LA, Texas, and Connecticut. And mm-hmm. he basically, if you see a flight case, most likely it's Calzone or Anvil. Anyway,
right here, and I'm from Connecticut. That's a Calzone case.
There you go.
Okay. Right here. Yep.
Sorry. There you go. So he invites me to his country club in Connecticut, a little west of New Haven. And he has a drummer buddy from Connecticut he's bringing. And he tells me, why don't you bring one of your drummer buddies? We'll have a drummer foursome. Hmm. So I'm like, okay, Connecticut. Who do I know in Connecticut? I know Bobby T. There's no way he's a golfer. I know Matt Starr. Okay. Call Matt. Hey, Matt, you golf? Sure. Okay, great. Meet me, you know, blah, blah, blah. Hook it up. I'm saying, oh, this is going to be great. So Matt shows up. I go, Matt, okay, put your clubs on my car, on my cart, you know. And he goes, oh, I didn't bring clubs.
He was going to play with his foot wedge.
So needless to say, Matt has not played much golf, but he was great. I mean, you don't have to play great golf. You just have to go out there and have a fun 4 hours, you know. But yeah, so talk about his game. Let's talk about his sticks first, his golf club.
Well, that's fantastic.
But funny, he just texted me. He's playing down in Florida, and he wants to hook up with a couple of drummers down there. I spend half my time down there. When it gets a little too cold up here, I fly south like a snowbird.
You so know. you're in Connecticut now, Joe?
I'm actually just a little outside of Connecticut. I'm in Pelham, New York, mm-hmm. Right outside of the city. It's like if you were driving into the city on 95, you would pretty much pass me. Yeah.
Okay.
And
where are you guys?
Well, I'm in Ontario, California. Rick is in San Diego. Chip yep. is in Tucson, and Jeremy is up in the Bay Area.
Wow!
I grew up in Manhattan.
Okay, me too.
Yeah, I saw you went to Brooklyn Tech.
I did.
Yeah,
I went to Brooklyn Tech, CCNY. But my real school was the Fillmore East.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that.
Wow. That was where I went to music school.
That's fantastic. Now, Rick's from Connecticut too, right, Rick?
I'm from Middletown, Connecticut. So all my early gigs were in the city and around Connecticut.
Very
and,
cool.
So I don't know. There's something in the water up there. There's so many great drummers up in Connecticut, New York, Long Island. It's amazing. Dom was there for a while. His early days were in Hartford.
Joe, let's jump into this. So I looked over your bio. Like I said, I'm a big fan of yours. I started working out of your book years ago when I was coming up and practiced out of your book, and I teach out of your book. I've had it so long. We talked about this before we went on the air. I have the old black and white version. Here's the red version. I have the black cover. And so you're so noted for that book, and congratulations on 40 years. You also played in The Good Rats. You played in Twisted Sister, and you played in Widowmaker. And both of those Widowmaker records are phenomenal, man. Stand By for Pain and the first one, that song Evil. The first time I heard it, I was like, oh my God. It was phenomenal. So great music. Talk to us about how you got started, how all of that stuff kind of came to be, and how the book came to be. Tell us a little, you know, brief synopsis of how you got started and what you did.
Well, you know, I just played in bands when I was a kid. You know, at first you played like high school dances and, you know, that sort of thing. And then once you were, you know, maybe 16, 17 with some phony proof, you started playing bars, and that's kind of what I did. You know, you just play around, and fortunately I was in New York City. So, you know, those bars were the Bitter End, the, you know, the Cafe Wa, Cafe Bazaar, all those really great village places. And, the time I grew up, like in my mid high school years, were the, you know, the late '60s, and basically it was all happening then, you know, the Fillmore East, the Electric Circus, all these great places in Manhattan where I can see Jethro Tull three times a year, you know, and see like one of my favorite drummers, Clive Bunker, or I could see Mitch Mitchell play with Hendrix, and I saw Baker, I saw everyone, you know, because that's the only way you can really learn back then, you know. Mm-hmm. I would just go see these guys multiple times a year. And through seeing them and buying their records and just soaking it all in, I kind of grew up, you know, I got really lucky near the end of my school years. I was asked to join the band Good Rats, and I finished school, and a year later I had a record deal on Warner Brothers. That was the Tasty album. I played in that band from 72 to 82. And probably played at least 250 gigs a year. So, you know, you talk about muscle memory. I think I could take 20 years off after that and still get behind the kit and make it happen, you know? that's a great upbringing, you know? By the time I got into the 80s and I had finished that whole run, I just had so much of a foundation, and talking about how the evolution of the book came about after playing in a band for 10 years. And then I toured briefly. I did a Canadian tour with a band called Chilliwack at the end of 82. And 83 is the first time in 10 years I didn't have a steady gig. So I've been wanting to write a drum book, because a lot of people complimented my double bass playing. And back then, there wasn't much going on double bass, right. You know? Ginger Baker was basically playing time on his left foot, brought it over to the bass drum and played 16th notes, you know? Carmine did the same. And Carmine, besides steady 16th notes, would play a double bass shuffle. And, you know, I always talk about this because it really was the first time that groove, that doo-ga-da-ga-doo-ga-da-ga-doo-ga-da, you know, the left foot lead, quarter notes left foot, right foot plays the last note of the triplet, that shuffle. Carmine did that in first Cactus album. So that was 69 or 70, maybe. Mm-hmm. 70, I think. So those were the two guys I learned from, and I developed a left foot lead, double bass roll, and shuffle. In fact, I was so into playing time on my left foot that even when I played triplets, it was left, right, right, left, right, right, left, right, right. I have a track on the second Good Rat album called Rat City in Blue, and the whole middle section is a triplet roll. It's left, right, right. And they, and there's a shuffle in there, the left, right, the shuffle goes from the shuffle to the steady roll, but the steady roll was still quarter note left foot, you know. So getting more into double bass, I decided that can't be the way to go. I wanted to play patterns. So in other words, if I were going to play boom, boom, ba, boom, boom, ba, I wanted to play tuga, tuga, ba, tuga, tuga, ba, you know. I wanted to make those eight notes at the 16th notes, but I wanted to retain the power of the right foot, you know?
Yeah.
Play. So that led me to turn it around and start leading with my right foot. And that wasn't easy to do because I was so used to playing those two grooves, you know? But I really wanted to explore double bass by playing patterns. Like I always conceived of, like, I can play a pattern and then maybe that inspires a guitar player to work off that pattern. And very much the way Yohira, some of these really cool metal bands that are out now, I don't know how they wrote their songs, but like the guitarist and drummer are playing these really intricate rhythms, double bass rhythms that are played note to note, you know, note to note on guitar. And I gotta believe that the drummer started these patterns, started these songs, you know, and that's kind of what I had in mind when I wrote the book, you know, to just be able to play something more musical, you know, rather than just digga 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 digga. So those patterns that you played in the beginning of the segment, Rick, those are basically what inspired me to start writing this book. So,
Joe, I want to make a comment about those patterns that I find so helpful for my own playing and my teaching, is that it's a practical system that if you just start eighth notes on the right hand, that one and two and, well, the notes that line up with that right hand are right foot. So the one and two and are right foot. The in-between notes, the E's and the U's, those are going to be all left foot. So you've got like a go-to footing that you can work with. Is footing, we always use the word sticking, but is footing a word? So it's so practical. And I think that's what messes people up a lot when they're trying to play double bass. They don't know what foot to use to play the rhythms. And you have that all spelled out here. And
well, I mean, you know, it's not the only way to play, but to me, it just made so much sense, because if I'm going to play fours and fours, you know, fours on the hand, four on the feet, I want to come out of that, you know. So if I go 3E and a 4E and a one, I want to be on the right foot to crash and hit an accent on the one. Yeah, that kind of thing. And I was doing that stuff, and I was going to my left foot lead, and then my left foot and right hand, it just didn't feel right, okay?
Yeah.
So that was the motivation. Yeah. But you have to understand where this thing came from, the left foot lead came from. It was always from playing Tom on your hi-hat, you know? I mean, Baker and Ainsley Dunbar, Carmine, all these guys. I mean, you know, you're playing the drums, and you're playing Tom here, right?
Right.
You're playing eighth notes or quarter notes or whatever. Even if you're playing nothing, you're feeling it there, you know? Even if you're wrong, you watch Omar play. And that left foot, even if he's not even playing the hi-hat, that heel is going, you know, up with eighth notes, you know? And so that's why the left foot lead thing came about. And that's why it was easier to play a steady roll leading with the left foot. But again, here I am. I've always wanted to explore double bass, and but I was always gigging. You know, it's not like, oh, yesterday I started with my left foot lead and now I'm going to start with my right. Yeah, that's not going to happen. That's going to take a few months, if not a year, to really turn things around. And I would talk to everybody about this as I'm exploring this concept. I talked to Terry Bozio. Okay, I tag him at a PAS show or whatever, or NAMM show, and say, Terry, when you play eighth notes, you lead with your left foot, right? And he goes, yeah, but does that bother you that you come out on your left on the one? And he thinks about it for a while, and he goes, no,
I just do a double right at the end. And I'm like, no, that's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to be more methodical and have this thing. So anyway, enough of it. That's how it came about, you know. And
now, real quick, let me interject this. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No.
When you're talking about the left foot lead, I'm on page 22 right now with the triplets. You're talking about leading the triplets with your left foot. Did you still lead 16th notes with your right foot as well?
No. I led everything with my left foot
before
I started writing my drum book. 16th notes were eighth notes on my left foot.
Wow.
Triplets
okay.
were quarter notes with my left foot.
Right.
And that's why I'm saying I was frustrated by that because I could play those two or three patterns, you know.
Right.
Just fine. But I wanted to do something more musical with my feet. And that was the evolution and the whole theory about, you know, and a perfect example is like what I said initially. If I'm playing 1 and 2, 3 and 4, I want to play 1 and 2, 3 and 4. I don't want to disrupt my right foot 1 and 3 and. I want to work around that because that's the strength of the beat, you know?
Right.
And if I want to play a 3 and, I'll lead the O. I'll use my left foot for the O. And it's just like anything else. Once you get used to it, you know, it's easy. You know, the easiest thing to play 1 E, a 2 E, a 3 E, a 4 E, and all those E's and O's start getting comfortable with your left foot. And same thing with triplets, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you start playing, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. And when I play a fast shuffle, I'm still going to play left foot lead.
Left foot lead.
Because it's just comfortable. It's what everyone does. Simon and, you know, Alex Van Halen, you know, everyone who plays a double bass shuffle, they usually lead with one foot or the other.
Right.
Thomas Lang uses...
Is a freak of nature.
Oh, man. But he uses my single stroke system in playing shuffles. Like, I do that in a slow tempo because you can go like that, to that, to that, to that, to that, and then you can fill in the middle note.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. He plays, look up on YouTube, Thomas Lang double bass shuffle. He plays, and it's really up tempo. Right, left, like that.
No
like,
way, yeah. Really.
And it's incredible. And sometimes he'll fill in the middle of note, you know. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, you know, because I do that in my video. I demonstrate that, but at a slow tempo. And it's kind of cool because you can always throw in that middle note and becomes more interesting. But he does it at lightning speed, and it feels really good.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Joe, when you were coming up there, like we mentioned, there's not a lot of double bass going on in the world. What were some of your inspirations on double bass? Did you ever check out Louis Belson or guys like that?
No. Louis was before my time, you know. I grew up with Ringo, you know. So that was on Ringo. Beatles came out. I was like 12 years old or so. You know, that was it, you know. And then I got really big into the second British Invasion, which I call Cream, Who, Hendrix, you know, that even though Hendrix was American, of course, it came out of Britain. That I got really into that. And you saw everyone. You saw like for instance, I mentioned Clive Bunker before. One year you'd see him with a 4-piece kit, maybe a 5-piece kit. And then the next year, once Baker became so popular, everyone was adding a second bass drum. Clive and Carmine and Mitch Mitchell, even, you know. Everybody, it was the thing to do, you know. So that's what really inspired me. That wave led by Ginger Baker, you know. But no, I did not really know much of. I mean, I had some Buddy Rich records because my uncle turned me on to Krupper and Buddy Rich. But I didn't know of double bass as Louis Belson. I knew of double bass Ginger Baker, yeah.
I got one more question for you, if you don't mind. It's a little bit, might be a little controversial or polarizing, I understand, but how do you feel about triggers on double bass?
Well, you know, here's the thing. If it works, great. I mean, the guys have the playing lightning speed. It really helps define what's going on. You know, I'm more of a purist. Mm-hmm. I play double bass to move air. You know, I like moving a lot of air. You can't do that when you're playing so fast, you know, and I'm not putting any of that down. I mean, I just read the new issue of Modern Drummer has an interview with El Espario. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name, but you know the dude.
Yeah.
And he talks about that in this interview. It's really actually a really good read. He's very honest and very humble in this interview. And he actually puts down his drumming, saying it's a little bit robotic, you know. He talks about the fact that just the way you tension your pedals, you have to tension them a certain way to play that fast, you know. And it doesn't sound good playing really slow, meaty stuff because the pedal is practically on the drum, you know. So that's not the school I come from, you know. I'm come from a single stroke, move a lot of air, old school double bass, you know.
Right on.
Always thought of that as like, you know, like a bass fiddle or, you know, like you're not going to play Eddie Van Halen riffs on, you know, an upright bass, you know, it's like a different instrument. And so that to me is what bass drum is all about, you know, something where whether you're watching a drummer or listening to a record, you know, the bass drum still have a lot of bottom to it and it moves you. And when the bass drums become like 250 BPM, they have to roll all that bottom out and just put clicks and they sound like, you know, they don't sound like bass drums the way I like hearing bass drums, you know.
Yeah. So
again, I'm not putting any of this down because some of my best friends play this stuff. I mean, Dennis Roddy, I mean, he's like phenomenal bass drum technique and he plays this amazing stuff that I can't even think like of playing. And there's so many great players that I really enjoy watching them develop this instrument of ours, you know, but it's just not me. Yeah. Nice.
I have an interesting story for you all that Gene told me, Joe, my brother-in-law is Gene Hoagland, one of the,
wow.
Yeah. And
yeah,
I was asking him one day about his triggers and he said he actually would go without the triggers, but his band mates like the triggers because they like that attack in the monitors.
Of course. Because
these BPMs are so fast.
I know, it keeps the band tighter.
Roll off the bass, you can't really hear that. So that attack makes it easier for the band to lock in. It's not even Gene's preference from what he told me to have those triggers, but it's for that reason too. So I thought that was an interesting story too.
Yeah, he plays some really great stuff. Yeah.
Yeah,
so, Joe, one of the things that you said a minute ago at the beginning of the interview, you said that you don't tour anymore, but you play some festivals and
I play
and
events. Like yeah.
Okay.
That kind of.
And are you doing drum clinics and are you teaching and stuff like that?
No, I'm not teaching. I actually would like to do some things on my YouTube channel, some more you know, educational things. I haven't gotten around to it, but that's what I plan to do. That's what I would love to do, as opposed to, okay, you come every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. I can't do that. You know, I'm trying to simplify my life and just doing whatever I want to do. And as it is, I don't know if you guys are aware, but I run an audio post facility in Manhattan where we do a lot of children's programming. Sesame Street and Blues Clues and some of the popular. Yeah. It's a really cool high-end facility. We're just doing a new show for Apple and mixing it in Dolby Atmos. And that takes a lot of my time as well. So for me to, there's so much time you have, you know?
Yeah.
But I can see myself someday post Beach Street, you know, with my production facility, of dedicating a lot of my time to doing that because I come up with ideas every day. I have like books and books of ideas. Some of it's a continuation of what I'm doing in my book. If you guys are familiar with my book, at the end, all I do is singles and doubles, just a variation of singles and doubles. It's just a bunch of paradigms.
Oh, yeah.
Over double bass. And what I encourage the user to do is, instead of playing these patterns over double bass, play them all over broken bass drum patterns. See, that's the whole essence of it, you know? Like, instead of playing a double paradiddle over a steady triplet roll, play it off of this. Yeah. Play that with your feet, with a double paradiddle with your hand. That is what I intended to go there, but you can't write out all this stuff. So I just do a blurb on it, you know. What I'm doing is, and that at the time in the 80s, that's what I was doing, singles and doubles over straight 16th notes or triplets or broken. Now I'm developing three-stroke patterns. Do you know Shirley Murphy's? Are any of you guys real nerdy about the hybrid rudiments and all of... Okay, so why not play a Shirley Murphy like a double paradiddle in triplet mode? You know,
okay,
you know, it's see, 12 is an amazing number, okay? So, with 12, it's very African, you know. So, if you're playing four triplets, there's 12, if you're playing in 6/8, there's 12 16th notes, right? Why 12 is so good? Well, one goes at the 12, two goes at the 12, three goes at the 12, four goes at the 12, six goes at the 12. So you can have all of these rhythms that meet on the one, you know? And so that's kind of what I spend a lot of time doing, you know? And not only playing things that are in threes and sixes, but like, say, play three paradiddles as the 12. And a two-bar phrase using six paradiddles, but accent them like they were triplets.
You know? Right. Okay. Yeah. So we take a couple of cycles to get around to the one.
But play a four-note sticking in three. You know. That kind. It's harder than it sounds.
but all that means
is like accenting the first of two doubles or the second of two doubles. Yeah. That kind of stuff.
I still got to look up a Shirley Murphy.
Shirley Murphy is 1, 2, 3. Right, okay. Left, left, right, right, left, right, right, left, left, left. Okay. Oh, okay. So sometimes they call them 1, 2, 3s. So, but think of a double paradiddle and substitute 2 1-2-3s instead of that. And you could still accent the middle of it. You know, you could still accent the seventh note by, you know, right, left, left, right, right, left. Boom. There's your accent. Yeah, so it's interesting, but it's not very common. Nara the Michael Walden plays threes a lot, and that's some of the stuff I'm working on. Anyway, that's what I said. Like I do things every day, and I develop stuff, and I would like to share some of that stuff, you know. So one of these days, that's one of my goals, you know.
I hope you do it soon. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Joe, with your production facility, it sounds like you could film and record and just put something phenomenal together.
You would think, but my great drum room is now a Foley room because we do so much Foley. They needed a big room to do footsteps and whatnot. And my drums are here now. These used to be at my facility, but the facility became, you know, we need more room, and Manhattan, it's, you know, room is sparse, you know,
right.
But I could do that someday and do it in there or convert this to more of a studio that I can film things in. And, yeah.
So you mentioned Narda, who, as we know, is like a really well-known producer, and you're a producer too. A lot of drummers we've had on our show have kind of, you know, put that hat on and become producers in their own right. How did you hone your producer chops? And when did you make that
transition? Very interesting story. I, in the mid 80s, would hear, okay, so you start hearing all these Lynn drums on record. And I was just like, no way. Mm-hmm. You know, and eventually it was like, well, oh, how come you hired him? Oh, because he had these Simmons pads. And he, oh, okay, I guess I should get those. At least I can hit those, you know. What turned me off to the Lindrum is it all sounded the same, you know. Not that it was a machine doing stuff, but it was everyone had the same hi-hat. Everyone had the same side stick. Everyone had the same, you know. Then about 85, the SP-12 came out, which was very interesting. I knew a guy who had one. I decided this would be a good time to dive into that. Something actually facilitated it. I did Fiona's second album and I did six songs. And after the six songs, he goes, well, now we're going to bring in a programmer for the next four songs. I'm saying, what? This is my, you know, I'm the drummer in this band. So that kind of kicked my ass a bit. Bo Hill, I have to thank for that. So I got into programming and I got pretty popular as a New York City programmer. I started doing a lot of records, Mariah Carey, Celine Dion, a lot of pop records that they would never call me to play drums on, you know, way too heavy handed for that stuff. But I started developing a programming thing and I was programming as much as I was drumming. Now, what's the point of this? Because I was programming, I'm at the other side of the glass and I'm looking at engineers and what's that? Oh, that's a compressor. What's that? That's the, you know, and I started learning a lot about that side of things. You know, when you're the drummer, you're in the room and you play a take, you're looking around to see, do they like it? You know, and that kind of thing. And when you're programming, you're right there with the producer and the engineer and you're learning a lot about gear. At that time, MIDI came about, and I'm saying, like, wow, you know, I'm programming all these amazing, cool African drum beats and grooves, and I can just punch a bass line over that, call a guitar player in, and write music, you know? So that whole thing came about, programming, MIDI, being on the other side of the glass. It kind of got me into developing, you know, a love for gear. And I put together a home studio in my loft in Manhattan, met my wife shortly after, and my studio became a baby's room. And that's when I opened up my facility called Beat Street 30 years ago. I can't believe it's 30 years, 95. So my two careers kind of overlapped, you know. I was still playing drums in Widowmaker back then, but I was also programming and I was moving my drums and programming and all my gear into this space that I had. I just walked down the Broadway on 22nd Street in Manhattan, found the space. I had my drums were, I was sharing a room with Jonathan Mover. We had a drum studio and I kind of closed that. Took my drums, took all my recording gear, set up shop. And about a year or two after that, I was asked to play drums in a children's TV show called Between the Lions. And I said, well, geez, you know, if you want to record me, you might want to come over and check out my studio because I'm like set up, mic'd up, I'm ready to rock here. They came to the studio and they said, whoa, we could do the whole show here. That started my second career, you know. So that's the long story of how the whole thing evolved. But it evolved through programming and learning a little more of that side, you know, of the producer and engineer side of things. And I became more of, you know, got more into composition, got more into production, got more involved, you know, and eventually wound up with a second career. And for me, that really worked out sweet because at a time you're you know, making kids and raising a family, you don't want to travel anymore. You want to be home with the family. And by having this facility that grounded me, and it was a good time because it was Widowmaker couldn't get arrested. We were playing small venues. It was at the time where the hair bands, which we were clumped into, were out and the Seattle bands were in. And so it was a perfect time to break from that scene, you know.
Let me ask you a question with that backing up from Widowmaker for just a second. You did you came in and met Dee Schneider in Twisted Sister. You were in Twisted Sister, right? And did you record an album with them or did you just do a tour?
Okay. I did the Love Is for Suckers album.
That's what I thought.
But I did a record with Dee before the Twisted record. He produced a band called Envy. Two sisters were in the band, like a heart kind of thing. And I don't know if he was feeling me out. Let's at least work with this guy first before I invite him to play with Twisted Sister. But during those sessions, he told me, I'm doing another Twisted Sister record, but I really want to do another band, and I'd like you to play drums in it. So that was the seeds of Widowmaker, you know, and then once the Love Is for Suckers record didn't take off, we started Widowmaker soon after. And that's a very long story. That took a long time to get off the ground. But you mentioned those two records, and they are my favorite records that I played on. I love that band, but it was just too late. That band should have came out when the last Twisted record came out. That should have came out 87, you know. Then it would have had a chance. But that was a killer band.
It was. The first song I heard on that record was Evil. And I remember a buddy of mine, we were at his house, and he just put on this record. And I was like, who the hell is that playing drums? And he goes, and then I'm like, well, he goes, well, tell me who the singer is. And I knew the voice, but I'm like, God, you know, I just didn't put two and two together that it was Dee Schneider. And I'm like, I don't know. He goes, well, it's Dee Schneider. No kidding. And then who's the drummer? And he knew that I was a fan of yours because he knew that we rehearsed together and he always saw this book. And so he's kind of bait me on. He goes, well, listen to it. And so I'm going, well, is that Carmine? No, it's not Carmine. Is it Tommy Aldridge? No, it's not Tommy. Uh-huh. And he goes, finally told me, he goes, it's Joe Franco. And that record had been out for a while, and the Stand By for Pain came out right after that.
Yeah.
Or Stand By for Pain was coming out when I had heard that record, and I got both of them. And man, I agreed. I was like, man, that band should have been just huge. I mean,
yeah, no major label support, two very small labels. It was, you know, I guess from a marketing standpoint, it was trying to sell an 80s rock star in the 90s, you know.
Yeah.
But tell you a funny story about Evil. Evil is, it's a Howlin' Wolf song.
Yeah, it's a Howlin' Wolf tune. Yeah.
But Cactus made that popular amongst people my age, maybe, 71 on their third album, Restrictions. And we always thought it was so badass, you know. So we would always start our rehearsals with Evil.
Really?
Because we all loved it, right? We had no intentions of recording it, but it was just like our, hey, our handshake, how you doing today, you know?
Yeah.
Plug in, you know. And so when we went into the studio to record the first album, we had no intention of recording Evil. But we went into the studio, and the first thing we did, and the producer said, what was that? Oh, that's just our warm-up song. Why don't you record it? Mm. So that's how Evil became, you know, part of Widowmaker. But that's an old Cactus song. And they just redid this, actually. Carmine just did a new Cactus record. And he had a bunch of people who were influenced by Cactus, everyone from Bonamassa, Billy Sheehan, to, you know, play on this record. And they did Evil again.
Yeah. Oh, did Joe, they really? Joe, I'd like to circle back to the conversation about your programming drum machines, because there's a really, really valuable story there for every up-and-coming musician. And there's always new technology coming upon us. And you were faced with that. You could have lost your job. Oh, we're just going to start programming. But you stepped up and said, hey, I'm going to be the programmer. And you figured that out. And your career had a rebirth. Probably it went even beyond what you were doing as a physical drummer, because it's so in demand. So congratulations to you for doing that. That's super incredible. And I think young people now, and anybody, we get so afraid of new technology. Everybody's freaking out about AI right now, but the lesson in there is you better figure out AI. You might be the next person who's figuring out AI and doing the next big thing, and whatever technology is out there, you know, try to embrace it rather than fight it. So you're a pioneer with that, man. So that's cool. And Kenny Arnoff had a similar story, how he started programming drum machines for John Mellencamp. So did you find it creative too? Like, was it suddenly I could be more creative, like do things that you can't physically do on drums? Like, was it fun?
It was amazing at the time because it was so new. That mm-hmm. was the appeal to me, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The appeal, like I said, the emulator, the SP-12 came out, and unlike the Lin, you can put your own sounds in there. That yeah. was the appeal to me. So I would trade the session. I'll play drums on the session. Give me the studio for a couple of hours, and I'd bring all my snare drums, and I would sample things. I would sample every nuance of a hi-hat, you know, tap, right-hand tap, left-hand tap, right side of the hi-hat, slightly open, a little more open, very open.
Yeah.
I would crossfade these and play them on a drum cat. Maybe an octopad before the drum cat even came out. And that would be my hi-hat programming. And my hi-hats felt like a hi-hat, you know. Nice. If you listen to some of the Taylor Dane stuff I did, or Mariah Carey even, it really has, because you can play it like that, and the accents are going to trigger the side of the cymbal, and the unaccented notes is going to be like the tip of the stick on the top. So you can play it, you can just play it like a hi-hat. And
yeah.
Felt like that, you know. So anyway, so I got super into that.
So cool.
After 2 or 3 years of this, by the early 90s or even mid 90s, they had so many sample CD-ROMs, and now they had these virtual instruments where every keyboard player was doing drum program. Everyone was doing it, and it was so easy to do. That, together with opening my studio, that's when I threw away my drum machines. You know?
Yeah, okay.
And now I have my real drums here. You know? It lost the appeal to me when it progressed, actually, you know, because it's like everyone was doing it. Keyboard players were programming drums, you know.
Yeah.
And so I got back into playing drums. And again, like this, the show that I started doing, I did the show for 10 years called Between the Lions, very, very Sesame-like show focused on teaching children how to read, you know. But we would be playing all this great stuff, like from Motown to, like, you know, country, the ballads to hard rock. It was a great, if you ever want to listen to some of that stuff, it's all on YouTube, you know, Between the Lions songs. And it was just like really a fun thing to do, you know, because, you know, no one's going to call me to play all these different styles, but being the drummer, the house drummer in this band, I was able to play so many different kinds of music. That was fun. That was a fun stretch.
That's so great.
Yeah, it was really good. Now I have to say, to be honest with you, it's the budgets aren't there, and most of our music that we use for shows is phoned in. If we do it, I have a bunch of composers, and they all have their home studios, and they, you know, they just basically phoned it in. You know, it's not like it was in the 90s, and I think I started that show in 98, 99. Where you had a real band come in, and it was like making records. It was really great. Unfortunately, the budgets aren't there for that anymore. So not as much fun as it used to be.
Well, I think that's a good lesson for, you know, Rick was talking about, you know, the technology thing and AI and everything. And this studio that I'm sitting in right now is a teaching studio. I've got 3 cameras, this one above me, one down by my feet. So I teach here. But I also do a lot of albums here. It's a recording studio. It's a great room for doing voiceovers because it's really quiet in here. I got a good Octava mic that's a large diaphragm for voiceovers. And I can record drum tracks all day, and I do stuff for sync licensing. So I think this is a great thing that you you can be an educator for the younger generation to say, look, you've got to know how to work Pro Tools or Logic or something and understand.
Yeah.
Well, you said it, Joe. What's that? Oh, that's a compressor. What's a compressor do to a snare drum? How does an exciter work? How do these things, what do they do to the instrument? And understand that stuff, right? I mean, knowing how to play is great, but knowing all the other stuff just makes you that much more valuable. Would you agree with that?
I agree. It just makes it more fun. You know, I enjoy both ends of it. I really, and as a drummer, I really enjoy records that sound better, you know?
Yeah.
We spoke about Michael Walden. Okay. Have you heard his last record, Immortality? Oh, actually, it's not his last record. It's two records ago. Immortality. It came out over COVID. It's probably 2 or 3 years old.
No.
But please download that record. It's right up there with Believe It, Spectrum. It's right up there. And the production, the drums are phenomenal sounding. And that just makes it so much more fun to listen to, you know. And I'm, you know, I come from a rock standpoint. So to me, when I heard Believe It, like, you know, I have all the Tony records, I have all the Miles records, but Believe It came out and they had a 24-inch kick drum. And
yeah, baby.
Tony was slamming on that record.
Joe,
I have to ask you something. What is your favorite bass drum pedal? What's the pedal of choice?
DW5000.
Bam. Beautiful.
There you go.
The classic.
There you go. Yeah.
So, you know, there are others. I remember, you know, God, I remember like companies would send me pedals to, you know, I remember Joe Hibbs, late RIP. Mm-hmm. When he was with Tama, he sent me those Iron Cobras when they first came out, right?
Yeah.
And like, Joe, if I were a kid buying my first bass drum pedal, I would dream of having this pedal. It was like a machine. It was built like a tank, but it doesn't feel like what I like the feel of, you know? The DW5000, I mean, not that they're chintzy, they're not, you know, like not like Speed Kings, but, you know, they're like, they just have a feel and a looseness about them that I like. You know?
Yeah, not over-engineered, but enough to be solid. And like you said, you're pushing air. That's the sound we're getting.
Yeah.
And a pedal like that lets you do it.
I like that pedal, and I'm not a big double pedal guy, but, you know, when I need to use a double pedal, I'll use a DW5000 double pedal, you know? Mm-hmm. That's my
the original with a single chain or like the double, the thicker chain.
I have both, the double.
Yeah. That's awesome. And you're a purist. You still, when you do a festival, you do a gig, you're carrying two bass drums.
No.
No,
it's not up to me. I did a thing, earlier this year with, Nico McBrain and Simon Kirk. Okay. And it was a charity thing, and we each played a half a dozen songs. So, you know, we play six songs each, right? And Nico was like, no. We have to play Nico's kit. So Nico's like, no double pedal. I did bring it though. But he didn't have the hi-hat where the leg shifted. So it was, forget about double pedal. Yeah. But I'll bring a double pedal with me. You can't have a double kick drum set there, you know, if it's like, you know, if it's not my gig, you know.
Yeah, right.
So I'll bring a double pedal. Or I'll play single bass, you know, like the other thing I did this year, I did a thing, there's this Long Island Music Hall of Fame. I did a thing with three Long Island bands, myself and, two guys in Zebra and two guys in Twisted Sister. And we put this whole thing together. We played it. It was a 4-piece kit, you know? So, you know, yeah. But I mean, when I went out and played, the last time I went out and played live, maybe 9 years ago and 10 years ago, I used to do summers with Dee Snider. It was a really fun band. For those gigs, I had a spec. I played double bass, you know, a regular kit that I'm comfortable, because I have to play a whole show, do a drum solo, you know, the whole nine. And those were fun gigs because we would play some Twisted songs, we would play some Widowmaker songs, and then we would play some songs that we just liked to play, AC/DC or Priest or, you know, some metal bands that we liked, you know. They were fun. But, you know, those gigs, when I'm going to play the whole show, I need to be comfortable, and I'll specify a double bass kit.
Oh, and so you, and so on that stuff, you were like backlined then, so you didn't.
Yeah, and backline. Wow, I don't remember backline being as good as it is nowadays. You know, I specify, and maybe because DW are popular, but I'd get all the sizes I asked for. I would get, you know, it'd be pretty close to comfort. You know,
of course, how long have you been with DW? Because you were with Premier for a long time, and they're no longer, right?
I was with Premier for 25 years. From I think 78 to 03. And then my buddy Tom Myers, when he left Premier, I didn't have a reason to stay, because a lot of times when you're with a company, it's because of the people who signed you. You develop a really close relationship. It was like Lenny DeMuzio with Zildjian, or you know, Tom Myers with Premier, you know. And when Tom left, I always loved DW, but I was a Premier guy, a loyal guy. I went to a NAMM show, I think it was 2002, 2003, and Don Lombardi, who I've known forever, and I've used his pedals, and he approached me and said, "Joe, when are we going to make your drum set?" And I said, "Tomorrow."
Yeah.
And I think, I'm pretty sure they're stamped 2003, so 21 years.
Wow. That's fantastic. Wow. That's awesome. And that's like your main kit then, that one.
Yeah, I really love it, you know, because at the time I got this kit, 2003, I was in the middle of the children's television thing. So I couldn't really have a 24-inch kick in the car. Yeah, I couldn't have that rock thing, you know.
That's what I was going to ask. What size is it?
Yeah, I tried to get something that worked for everything. I could do a metal gig with this kit. I've done metal gigs with this kit. Prog gig with this kit. Or I can play children's television. I just changed the snare drum, you know. I'll take a 13-inch aluminum drum that I have over there somewhere and make that my snare drum. But with this kit, what I love about this kit is the spread in toms. I have a 10, a 13, a 15, and an 18.
I can get a fourth
out of each of those drums.
Even
out of the two floor toms because of the 15. Now, when Garrison at DW and John Good, these guys were like, "You want a 15. You know, because I was saying, I'd like a 10 and a 13 because I can really play. That's a really nice spread. I use the 13 mostly, but nice to have a 10 for going there, going for that high pitch. But 15, I said, that's not going to work. I'm a 16 guy. You know, I can't, you know, that's not a floor tom. And they said, I tell this story a lot. He says, "Okay, we're going to make you a 16, but we're also going to make you a 15 and you're never going to use the 16. I go, "Try me." Never use the 16. Why? Because it's ballsy. It's a great sound, that 15. It sounds like a floor tom. It sounds like a 16. Yeah. But the cool thing is it brings the 18 in, an extra in. It brings it a little closer. And I can get a big spread between the 15 and 18, much more so than between a 16 and an 18, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's the story of that spread. And then I use an Edge snare drum, which is like an amazing drum, but it's so loud that I could never use it in anything other than a hard rock or metal kind of a gig, you know? So I have a lot of alternate snares that I'll use, including the 13 that I use for children's television. I use that for years.
Is that the Edge snare? Is that the one, the Zildjian one that they?
No, I got that one too. I got a couple of Zildjian drums. I got the Noble and Cooley one. Well, I could show them to you, but that'll take forever. I'll get really sidetracked if I start doing show and tell. I've got the Noble and Cooley one, and I've got the new 400th anniversary one, which is amazing. What an instrument that is, right? But the Ed snare, it has, because I'm a brass guy, I always love brass snare drums, especially for fighting through guitars, you know. The Ed snare has the top rim and the bottom rim of, I don't know, 2 inches of brass, and then the middle layer is wood. So there's a warmth of wood and the crack of metal.
That it's, this one's the exact opposite. It's two things of wood and brass in the center. That's what.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Who makes that?
This is a Gretsch. I'm with Gretsch. I'm a Gretsch guy. Wow. So yeah. Yeah.
I never heard of that.
You know, they made it for a minute, and it's kind of their version of a free floating drum. It's not really a free floating drum, but it's their version of it.
Yeah.
It's a great sounding drum, man. It's a great sounding drum.
Woo. I said I wasn't
going to
do
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
You got him going. You got him going.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you can see that just about an inch of brass just for the crack. And then you got the wood in the middle. So it's warm and fat, but boy, it's got crack for days. Mm. And it weighs a ton as well. It's really heavy.
Yeah, I bet it's
very cool.
Hey, you know what? We're running out of time, Joe, but we haven't asked this question in a while. I don't know if we forgot or what, but since you're East Coast, New York, Connecticut, East Coast guy, we have to ask this because we used to ask it. The most important question of the day in every episode. You're ready, right? You're ready for this.
I'm totally ready.
Okay. All right. Where's the best place to get pizza around your where you live?
Well, Ray's went out of business, okay, which is really a shame.
Ray's on 11th? On 11th went out of business?
11th. My daughter used to go to school on that block. Do you know how many Ray's slices I had? She went to school on 11th Street between just a little west of 6th Avenue, PS 41. And I passed Ray's every day or those eight years or however many years she went to that school. That was the bomb, you know. But I got to be honest with you. Later on, I kind of got away from that really salty, cheesy New York slice that everyone likes. And this is so sacrilegious, but I'm more like into the fresh moots now, you know. And I have a place that's right at my studio, 928 Broadway, right next to the Flatiron Building, and it's called Obica.
Obica.
O-B-I-C-A, or it might be Obica, but Obica. It's like eating pizza in Italy, but it's more fresh mozzarella, soft crust. It's amazing. If you're ever on Broadway and 22nd, between 22nd and 21st, it's right in the middle, and that's nice. That's the building my studio's in. So I just go downstairs and have a pizza. So yeah, that's my fave, Obica.
Nice.
I love talking to people from the East Coast about pizza because it's like a religion. It's
It is.
Oh, that's my right. God. Yeah. 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 That's awesome. Joe, thank you so much for doing our show today. We appreciate it so much. And
great hang.
And entertain. Yeah. Yeah. This is a great hang. I'll get you over the link once it's up on not only on YouTube, but also on Spotify. And thanks so much for being part of it. This is great having
thank you guys, man. I'll tune in more often.
Yeah, right on.
Good to have you.
Okay, Rick, thanks play us out, baby. Give us some double bass.